developed in collaboration with Oscar Diaz, who is here in the audience, so you can address all complicated questions to him, and with Gary Horowitz. If I have time, I will also talk about some of the work that we are currently exploring with Don Marolf. So let me also mention that this work was only possible because there was another paper by Piotr Bizon and one of his collaborators, Rostorowski, that have shown an amazing property, in my opinion, about anti-de Sitter space, which I shall explain. So I'm here this morning to tell you about the gravitational turbulent instability of anti-de Sitter space. So the first thing that I'll do is to disentangle the title of this talk. First, I'm going to argue that anti-de Sitter space is unstable, okay? But it's unstable not to any type of instability. It's an instability that is very reminiscent of what happens at the onset of turbulence, where the word turbulence here means that there is a cascading direction for this instability. And also that is a rather universal instability, because just with gravity, you can herald this instability. Just gravity, don't need anything else, okay? So I don't need to motivate this much, given the topic of this conference, time dependence in anti-de Sitter. It seems that the first thing that we should learn is about the stability of the background itself. So that's what I'm doing here. Okay, so let me dive immediately and just remind you of the properties about anti-de Sitter space that I want you to keep in mind throughout the talk. So what is anti-de Sitter space? Well, anti-de Sitter space is just a maximally symmetric solution of Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant. And in global coordinates, it looks like so. Let me introduce my manifold. I have a global time t. I have a radial coordinate that plays the role of the radial direction like in Minkowski space. And then for each tr hyperslice, I have a d minus 2 sphere. Just keep in mind that there's a d minus 2 sphere there, okay? Now, there's an infinitely set of coordinates that you can use in anti-de Sitter space. Another set of coordinates are the Poincaré coordinates, which are often used in applications of holography to condensed matter physics. But the coordinates that I'm going to use are global coordinates. So there's a pictorial way of seeing the difference between these two sets of coordinates. And we just note this by reminding ourselves that in global coordinates, or ADS in global coordinates, is just conformal to the interior of a solid cylinder. So you just multiply this metric by L squared over R squared, and it asymptotes to the Einstein static universe. So let me put this in pictures. This is the whole of anti-de Sitter space. And this brown shaded wedge is covered by the Poincaré coordinates. The instability that I will talk about here in this talk will only show up if you do the calculations in global coordinates. It's very simple, the reason for why this is the case. It's a very long-lived instability. So you might start in one Poincaré edge, but the instability will only occur somewhere else in another Poincaré wedge, okay? Also, because we're working with the global coordinates, our field theory lives on the Einstein static universe. So keep in mind that if we freeze time, the field theory lives on a compact manifold. This will be important later. And also, I'll be using coordinates such that they preserve the energy. So you start with a little wave inside ADS, you scatter off to infinity, it will return to you in a finite amount of time. Okay? Good. Any questions? So this is the basics of ADS. I hope I haven't said anything that you already didn't know. Good. So every time I give this talk, people doubt about my notion of stability, they complain. So I want to get this out of my way. I'm going to tell you what, for relativistic, is an instability. Okay? For most relativists in this audience, this definition will be very loose. For most people that do string theory, this notion of instability will be very technical, okay? So I'll try to meet somewhere in the midterm. So consider a space-time with a certain manifold and with a certain metric. And if there is a time-like boundary, then you also have to prescribe some boundary conditions, okay? Now, let us consider a Cauchy surface inside this space-time. And let us perturb it ever so slightly, okay? What happens to the future development of this Cauchy surface? Does it approach the same space-time we started with, or it goes to something different, okay? In particular, is the asymptotic causal structure of the resulting space-time the same as the one we started with? If you're a physicist, this is all you need. If you're a mathematician, you want to go a tiny bit further. You want to make a quantitative prediction. So you want to make sure that you bound the difference of your spacetime at future infinity in terms of some initial data that you specified in your Cauchy surface. This is what mathematicians typically do. Now, this is a remarkably difficult problem. Even for Schwarzschild, we don't know the answer to this question. We have overwhelming numerical evidence that Schwarzschild is nonlinearly stable, but we don't know for sure. Let me just tell you why it's so difficult. One of the nonlinear perturbations of Schwarzschild takes you to Kerr. So unless you prove the stability of Kerr, you have not proved the stability of Schwarzschild. Okay? Now, in the case where we have a lot of symmetry, in particular when your spacetime is geodesically complete, we can reformulate this in a different setting. If you start with a geodesically complete spacetime, you perturb it ever so slightly, does it remain geodesically complete or not? Seems a simpler question. So what are the types of spacetimes that are geodesically complete and that we know and love in physics? Well, there's entire Sitter space, Minkowski space, and the Sitter space. You basically have no singularities behind horizons, or you know, you can extend your geodesics to cover all of your spacetime. So at the linear level, if you consider infinitesimally perturbations, they all look stable. They're all alike, okay? At the nonlinear level, however, it was shown that the Sitter space is nonlinearly stable and that Minkowski space are nonlinearly stable. What does this mean? It means that if you start with a small but finite perturbation about these two spacetimes, they will remain small. They will disperse off to infinity. Yes?
What you're saying about the Sitter global,
yes,
a bit contradicts to what I know from Lipschitz's study of global Sitter. If you start from small nonlinear perturbations,
no,
at the past of the Sitter space.
Right. You have to be careful on how you define small to start with. You have to build a norm in a suitable sense and where a lot of the work goes here. No, right. That is true. So you have to be careful with the boundary conditions that you put at the past infinity as well. Now let me mention that for the Sitter space, this proof is actually not that difficult, because the Sitter expansion helps you, helps disperse gravity. For Minkowski space, if you are above five dimensions, this proof is also not that difficult. It's only like 100 pages proof. Okay, it's not something that you take a lot of work to do. However, for four dimensions, this is remarkably difficult. If you have a first look at the Einstein equations, it will actually look that they're nonlinearly unstable. They're not, but there's a lot of work that goes into this. It took a 500-page monogram to show that Minkowski was linearly stable, and this was the work, remarkable work of Christodoulou and Kleinerman in 1993. It's a very complicated paper. I don't advise anybody to read it, to be honest.
Well, there's a second paper by
which is a lot easier. I know.
Linda.
Yeah, where they basically, yeah, where they basically translated what was there. So this has never been shown for anti de Sitter, right? And at the time, I just thought, well, these guys are mathematicians. They don't care about anti de Sitter. It's just more complicated. But a lot of years have passed. So one can ask, why has this never been shown for anti de Sitter? And the answer is very simple. It's just not true. So I'll present the main claim of this talk. Generic, small, but finite perturbations about AdS become large and eventually form black holes. I will be able to show that generic, small perturbations become large. I will not be able to show that they will eventually form black holes. This is out of the scope of what I can show. Okay? But we have some numerical evidence that this is indeed the case. Furthermore, as the system evolves towards the formation of a black hole, it doesn't evolve in any way. There's an energy cascade from low to high frequencies in a manner that is very reminiscent of the onset of turbulence, and before Lewis kills me, in spatial dimensions bigger or equal than 3. Okay? I'll give you a little bit on the field theory side, but unfortunately not as much as I would like to. No, that's a very good question. The Jeans instability, we think it's related to another instability that I will also allude to here, which is instability around Schwarzschild AdS. But more of that later. Okay, so when I present results like this, people either start leaving the room or they say, this guy is completely nuts, this can't be. Because, in fact, somebody entered in this case. In fact, doesn't this contradict the fact that anti-de Sitter is supersymmetric? I mean, the standard law is that supersymmetric theories are stable. Well, there's also a positivity of energy theorem. So if you have a positivity of energy, you surely have stability. So doesn't this contradict these two statements? The very short answer is no, it doesn't. Okay? So one usually uses the first one to show that the Hamiltonian is the square of some operator, and thus implies a second one. But what does this statement mean? It tells you that if you start with some initial data that is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, and if it's smooth, okay, that the energy is bounded from below. It's only zero for anti-de Sitter. Okay? This only ensures that anti-de Sitter space cannot decay. That's what this means. But it doesn't tell you that if you add a little bit of a perturbation inside anti-de Sitter, that will not necessarily form black holes. In fact, you argue this by arguing that waves disperse. But there's a tiny bit of a problem. Waves do not disperse in anti-de Sitter. They just bounce back and forth. This fact was picked out by two mathematicians, Gustav Osaldag and Michaelis de Fermus, and they immediately said anti-de Sitter is unstable because of this. They have a lot of intuition from PDE theory, so they immediately stated this. In fact, they went further. They said all asymptotically global EDS solutions are nonlinearly unstable. Yes? Right. No matter. Yeah, I'll get back to that point because that we don't know. No. Only if you include quantum mechanics. If you include quantum mechanics, this instability is just not there. No, right. What I'm saying is if you don't include quantum mechanics in the game, you always form a black hole. No. Look. No. Wait. But this is interesting because I'm using this in the ADS-CFT context. So I'm taking the large. I'm looking at the very strong coupled field theory. Okay, and that's dual just to classical gravity at extremely large n. Of course, this is a large n artifact. And in fact, if you include large n corrections, you'll see that the instability will not be there, but it will change our picture about thermalization. And the answer is yes, and this has been shown. So even in flat space, this happens. ADS is nothing special, except it acts like a confining box. I just told you, there's no instability. What happens is the following. If the energy, I mean, I'll get back to this in the end. I'll tell you what happens in string theory, okay? The end. Okay. But this is a bunch of mathematics. Why really is ADS unstable, right? Well, there's a simple argument. You put a little bit of energy inside a box. You expect it to explore all configuration space that is compatible with that tiny amount of energy. One such configuration space is a tiny black hole. There's the highest entropy. Surely it goes there. Now, this type of argument would tell you that the instability has a very long time scale. It looks like an ergodic time scale. This is the wrong picture to have in mind. It's not because of this that anti-de Sitter is unstable. There's a stronger mechanism that makes it be unstable. Okay? But if you run this argument backwards, then we might expect that some very special solutions might evade this instability, because they just don't go to these corners of the moduli space where you would form black holes. And indeed, that's true. You'll see that for some set of linearized gravity modes, we'll be able to construct a nonlinear solution, which we coined gions. In fact, we didn't. It was Wheeler that coined in the asymptotically fed context in 52, which are just some lumps of gravity that go around in ADS, and they never form any instability. But they're very special in the sense that they're exactly periodic in time. And you only have one single continuous symmetry, which is a helical symmetry. They're very special solutions. In flat space, no, they leak to infinity, they disperse. The first people that tried to construct this was Jim Hartle and Brill, and they got to that conclusion. So a beautiful paper. Now, these dunes should be seen as the analog of gravitational plane waves in ADS. But if you take this analogy, that it doesn't come as a surprise that anti-de-Sitter is unstable, just because whenever you collide two plane waves, you generically form singularities. Beautiful paper by Penrose in 71 in Nature, back in the days where Nature would accept decent things. Okay. So I just told you what happens in anti-de-Sitter and why is anti-de-Sitter unstable. How do we go about to show this? Okay. So what we're going to do is to do perturbation theory. But we're not just going to do the linearized perturbation theory. We go high order in perturbation theory. In fact, we went to fifth order in perturbation theory. Okay? Just because we were asked to. You will see why. So what is the setup? Start with a certain metric. You take global ADS, which is this G bar, and then you expand it as a tower. Now, I will claim that certain solutions are regular and smooth, and you will not have any problem, do not grow in time, for all of these AGIs. And the first question that people ask me, and rightfully so, is this series convergent? Do you know anything about the asymptotic series? And unfortunately, I don't. So we only have some evidence. But if you're a mathematician, you don't believe in us. Okay. Now, if you input this into Einstein's equations, at each order in perturbation theory, Einstein's equations always have the same structure. Don't get scared. There's a second order differential operator here, which is a close cousin of the Lichner-Horvitz operator. And it only depends on the background, okay? And it acts on the ith perturbation. And this is equal to a stress energy tensor. Now, this looks simple because I've cheated. All the complications in this equation I've included here. If you look this at second order, this is the so-called Landau-Lifshitz pseudo-stress energy tensor, which is an absolute mess. If you go to third order, fourth order, well, they don't even have names for a good reason. They're just too complicated, okay? So in fact, part of our problem was to calculate this up to fifth order in perturbation theory. Good. But this is also a PDE, and it depends on many variables. And we want to get rid of this angular dependence. Well, if you were in doing quantum mechanics, that would be easy. If I'm given a potential that is spherically symmetric, what do? Well, you expand in terms of spherical harmonics. And then the dependence on the angles just appears through the quantum angular numbers of the spherical harmonics on your equation. So what we're going to do here is to do the same. But we're going to do an expansion instead of spherical harmonics in tensor harmonics. Okay? So you're going to expand the right-hand side of this equation in terms of very simple building blocks that have definite transformation properties under the SOD minus one group that sits inside ADS. Okay? There's a sphere sitting there. Now, for an arbitrary stress energy tensor with a very complicated angular dependence, there can be an infinite number of L's and M's that you need to specify in order to reconstruct your stress energy tensor. But we'll always be careful with our choice of our initial data, such that this number is always finite. The number of L's and M's that you need is always finite. Finite, it's better than infinite, but there can be as many as, you know, 100 terms in this expansion. So let me be a little bit less abstract and tell you how we construct these simple building blocks.
So if we use that, what's the constraint that this finite as the number of terms imposes on the initial state? Is it some symmetry that you require?
No symmetry. It just means that you start with a finite number of modes at a given order, at
so
first
your
order.
Perturbation
it's not like two or three modes and then at each order. It's the same if basically what I'm going to do is the Clebsch-Gordan decomposition. So if you start with the two angular momentum that we learned in quantum mechanics, then we expand it as a finite number of terms. It's the same here. So let me tell you how to build these guys. For those of you that are familiar with perturbation theory in gravity, this is your bread and butter. So for concreteness, let us set d equals 4. Then perturbations come in three classes. There are perturbations which are built out of scalars. There's the so-called scalar type perturbations. The scalars are scalar harmonics on the S2, so they're just the usual spherical harmonics. There are also vector-type harmonics. And these, because you are in two dimensions or because the sphere is two-dimensional, are just odd duals of the gradients of the spherical harmonics. And because you're in four dimensions, well, there's actually no tensor-type perturbations. We have done our calculation in 5 and 6. Everything matches. It's the same. Now, I'm going to give one technical thing. If you were doing quantum mechanics, you would use the complex representation for the spherical harmonics. But gravity is real in all senses. So in order to go up in perturbation theory, we have to use the real representation for the spherical harmonics. So for each value of L and M, we in fact have to use cosines and sines. OK? I hope this is the only technicality during this talk. One at a time.
So you don't correct the harmonics at each order in perturbation theory? You just use the zero order?
Because, well, you'll see that we'll correct the harmonics. Yes, we will. No, 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 no. You don't have tensors with respect to the S2, right? But you have scalar type perturbations that are tensor scalar type perturbations. These are tensors that are built out of scalar harmonics or tensors. It's the Reggie Wheeler decomposition or the Zerilli decomposition. It's
right.
This.
So you have the same thing. So you have, you don't have the tensor.
It's just a modern language of rephrasing this. If you have more complicated geometries, for instance, if you have the Myers-Perry black hole with all angular momentum aligned with each other, then you actually consider vectors or scalars or tensors with respect to the complex projective space that sits inside. So it's just the modern language of saying the exact same thing. Keep in mind Zerilli and Reggie Wheeler. Right. Easy. The boundary conditions are just normalizability at infinity and smoothness at the ADS center. Now, what is remarkable is that at each order in perturbation theory, by doing this procedure, we get rid of the angular dependence. Well, we're still left with PDEs in T and in R. We just got rid of the angles. What is remarkable is that Kodama and Ishibashi have shown that this, in fact, reduces to 4 gauge invariant variables that are decoupled from each other. The spatial, on the spatial.
On the boundary.
Yes. Yeah. Applies to Schwarzschild ADS as well. Yeah, yeah, it's spherically symmetric.
Yes, yes, but it's a static spherically symmetric.
Yeah. If the back, oh, you're asking, OK, good. So the Kodama, wait a minute. I'm now answering to him. Kodama and Ishibashi have a zero stress energy tensor, right? Because we have decomposed the stress energy tensor as a sum of the scalar harmonics, which are the exact same thing that sits on the right hand side, we can still do this decomposition. No, this is perturbations of ADS, pure ADS. It's your turn now. No. We'll impose. We'll choose our initial data, together with some boundary conditions. Okay. Remarkable thing is that these equations decouple. Okay. We're left with 4 decoupled gauge invariant perturbations. It doesn't get better. They're gauge invariant in everything. Okay. There's still this wave operator, but this is just with respect to T and R, orbit space. Furthermore, I have made this comment that you need a real, you know, the cosines and the sines. But in fact, once you have the cosines, you get the sines for free. Right. Because when you're at linear order, you don't need to worry about the real making your real section real, your metric real. Because you just take the real part, it's linear. But at nonlinear order, you need to worry. Because you need to always have the real part of the metric. The metric is real. It's not a complex thing. But it turns out there's a special symmetry in your equations. And once you know this guy, you know the other guy. So in fact, for each value of L and M, you only non-trivially solve for 2, and you get the other 2 for free. For each value of L and M. But I stress, you first calculate the stress energy tensor, and then you have to see how many L and M's you need to reconstruct it. So this looks not too much, but you'll see that this is a lot. Let us see the linear result. This is a result that we are, I think, familiar with. Because the space-time is time translation invariant, we can decompose this in Fourier modes in time. That's what I'm done here. You input this into the Kagami-Shibashi variable, and you get the Sturm-Liouville type problem with respect to these frequencies. Okay? And this tells you that only certain frequencies are allowed to propagate inside ADS. That's because it acts like a box. It's not surprising. Where L is an angular momentum quantum number, and this P just counts the number of radial nodes along the radial direction. Okay? The fact that this is positive tells you that ADS is linearly stable. This is a result that we're familiar with. Okay, so just to make sure that we know that these functions are actually not too complicated, let me show you one for P equals to zero. This looks like a rational function of R. If P is different from zero, then this gets to be multiplied by an hypergeometric function. Hypergeometric functions might look complicated, but because there's some quantization condition, it reduces to some Jacobi polynomials. It's not very complicated. Now, how do we go beyond the linear perturbation theory? You take the Kagami-Shibashi variable, and it so happens that there exists a linear differential map that takes you from the Kagami-Shibashi variable to the actual metric perturbations. So in your language, if you construct the Zarelli function and so on, you can reconstruct the metric perturbations in a given gauge, of course, because these guys are gauge invariant, but these guys are not. Then the really tough part comes. You have to calculate the stress energy tensor at the next order. This part, it's complicated, but fortunately, Mathematica can do it for you. You can make Mathematica sweat and do this work. Okay, it's systematic. The really tough part is to decompose this as a sum of these building blocks. This would be like having a Clebsch-Gordan decomposition for tensors. Such a thing does not exist. So you have to do it by inspection. And for instance, at fifth order, there are more than 100 L's and M's, which we have to do by inspection, by looking at the form and seeing how many L's and M's you'd have to do to generate the function.
So I'm confused about this point, because this P, I plus 1, will be sums of products.
Derivatives and so on.
But each of those terms that enter
right
has some definite transformation properties. So
right.
I take representation theory, I multiply them, I decompose them into
irreducible
representations,
right.
And then my PLM.
Right. But you have to be careful here. First of all, I've never seen this done anywhere, point one. Second, you have to be careful because scalars and tensors and vectors, they all mix.
I believe
it can be done. I believe it can be done. I've never seen it. And we've tried it, and it's a lot more complicated than what you think. But we've tried it. So if you can cook up this, actually, I think this would be a useful technique for nuclear physics, for instance, where they need this type of thing. And we've searched the literature, we couldn't find it. So because I'm a little bit obsessed, so I decided to do it the hard way, by inspection.
Can you go one time? I just want to look at the form for the scalar.
No, this is a simple form. This is just with no nodes. But when P is on. Of course, it's an hypergeometric function. Multiplies here an hypergeometric function. And in fact, look, we might start with this simple guy, but at higher orders, we generate P is different from zero, P is equal to zero. I mean, it's a mess. Okay, once you have this, then it's mechanical. You calculate the right-hand side of the Kagami-Shibashi variable because you already know the L's and M's, and then you solve for this guy. Now, this looks complicated, right? Because I'm saying you have a stress, and you still have to solve a PDE. But it's not very difficult. Because if this guy has an oscillatory dependence in R, then so will the Kagami-Shibashi variable. Can show this by the method of annihilators, your favorite method, taking Fourier transforms, it's up to you. There is one exception. If the term oscillates precisely with the normal mode's frequency, then there will be a resonant term. There will be a mode that grows linearly in time. Okay? So I want to stress this. This is like having a simple harmonic oscillator. If you drive it with the exact same frequency as the natural frequency of the harmonic oscillator, you get a term that grows linearly in time, instead of getting two things that oscillate. Now, this gives us an operational way of defining what one means by instability. If, to all orders in perturbation theory, you can always construct these Kagami-Shibashi variables, and we never need to add this term, the solution is said to be stable. If, to a given order, you need to include this term, that is to say, regularity at the origin and normalizability at infinity tells you that this term has to be there, then the solution is said to be unstable because you have a mode that is growing linearly in time, eventually will become of the same order as the background, and perturbation theory breaks down.
So, sorry,
Yes.
And therefore, your perturbative expansion
right.
will break
breaks
down.
Down.
When this becomes another one perturbation, then you don't know what happens after that.
Exactly. That's why I'm saying I can show that perturbations become large.
No, but we know a lot of systems like, you know, non-linear and so on.
On spheres, right?
Classical level.
Perfect. That's the UV. Perfect. Perfect. And
they're
you'll
not
see.
That stable or anything.
No. This is an instability from our perspective because you started with a solution and you're going towards a different solution. And this is the UV catastrophe theory. That's what you're trying to say, that quantum mechanics resolves.
No,
right?
I'm talking about quantum mechanics. I'm saying classically, I mean.
On a sphere, for instance. On a compact space, they're unstable in the same sense. In fact, Piotr Bizon is simulating that. And this is the UV catastrophe theory. It's just that. You try to thermalize, but that's no quantum mechanics.
Do I correctly understand that what you are saying is that on the right hand side, due to non-linear and refraction of the waves,
yes.
you have an external force in a sense, which parametric, not parametric, just makes a resonance for the.
Might make or not. Yeah. And that's what we want to investigate, if it
okay.
makes or not. But that's perfectly that. It's exactly that.
If you were to do this procedure for the sitter, I know this is kind of naive.
Uh-huh. You won't find this.
You won't find it. Where is the crucial difference?
The difference is that this
quantization.
It's this quantization condition doesn't exist. So it's these guys are integers. That's what makes life complicated.
Right, because it's a
they're commensurable. They're commensurable. That's what makes life complicated. Okay, let us give some examples. We start with L equals M equals to 2. So happens that if you start with the highest weight representation, which is this guy, for instance, calculations become a little bit easier. So, sorry? No. The energy that you put in is the energy that you find in the end. No, right. But I would have to go to the next order to see that the energy is conserved. There's some modes where the amplitude is decreasing, and that's very important. So we start with this mode. At any even order, one can show that there's absolutely no problem. So it's regular, there's no resonances. And we can show this mathematically. At third order, there's one single resonant mode. And if you're not careful enough, you would say, that's it. ADS is unstable. But you have to be careful, because you can resum this mode that seems to be growing in time into something a lot simpler that does not blow up in time. How do we do this? You see, the problem is that you might have started with the wrong basis to expand your perturbation theory at the higher order. You have to correct your basis at the higher order. A simple way of doing this is to promote the frequency that you started with, which was 3, to be a function of your parameter in the expansion of epsilon. If you do this, this mode that seems to be growing in time just disappears. So for a single mode data, the third order is regular. When we did this, Piotr Bizon said, well, that's all fine, that's all good. But we went to fifth order in one of our calculations, and we could not remove the growing mode in time just by doing a shift in the frequency. So in Cambridge at night, I decided to do the calculation to fifth order. And it so happens that you can do precisely the same. There would be 4 resonances, but magically, there's only 1. Okay, at fifth order. And by correcting this guy, you still get rid of it. So you think that the structure of the equations seem to indicate that if you start with a single initial mode, I don't know why this is not working. Well, I'll use this one. If you start with a single initial mode, then you can remove it by doing this procedure. So we think these solutions exist even at the nonlinear level. But now it's a time where you should ask me, well, do you know if the series converges? And we don't. Okay, so you should see this just as good indication. However, we have done this calculation in some certain numerical, you know, some numerical calculations in certain simple circumstances in 3 dimensions, and it seems that the solution exists at the nonlinear level, but in 3 dimensions. Here, this is where we need desperately your help. Numerics is essential to do this. Okay. Now we have to solve a lot of equations as we go up in perturbation theory. So we'd like to have some way of checking that what we're doing is correct. One such thing is to check the first law of thermodynamics. And this solution obeys to that law. So it seems that we're doing the right thing. Also, this gives us a physical way of defining what one means by our parameter expansion. It's just epsilon is just related with the angular momenta. Okay.
So, just one question.
Yes.
But you would expect these solutions to be unstable.
Right, but with a different time scale. Why? The normal modes of these solutions are continuous deformations of the normal modes of ADS. But if they're continuous deformations of the normal modes of ADS, they're no longer commensurable. It's not true that if you subtract and sum, that you'll get another normal mode frequency of this guy. So for these guys, unless there's a surprise, there might be some other nonlinear instabilities that you're not aware of. I would have to perform perturbation theory around these guys. It seems that the time scale might be really ergodic. It might take a long time. Yes. It's still to be, well, that's a very good question. Bison seems to find in his calculation, where he just has a single scalar field, modes that are radial, just radial in nature. However, he finds a problem at fifth order, which I don't find. So I don't know, numerics. This is, you know, we need your help here. It's numerics that will settle this. OK, but what if, let's go to a less speculative setup. What if you start with two modes? Well, if you start with two modes at even order, there's no problem. We can always show this, okay? At the third order, instead of one resonant mode, we find four. In fact, the number of modes, resonant modes, grows factorially. In case somebody will, you know, ask me a very complicated question afterwards, but it seems that nobody will. So you can remove two of the frequencies that are growing up in time just by doing the exact same thing you did before to the single mode initial data. You correct the frequencies of the two modes you started with. You just use the wrong basis to expand things. The mode with the lowest the mode with the smallest frequency that is still resonant, it's just zero. Just not there. And it's not there because normalizability at infinity and regularity at the origin tells you that the coefficient of that mode is zero. Okay, it's a magic cancellation. However, there is one mode, which is the mode that has the highest resonant possible frequency that grows linearly in time, and that we were not able to resum whatsoever. Okay, so there's a mode that is growing linearly in time whose frequency is larger than any of the frequencies we started with. Okay, and that the roughness of this wave, so the scales that this wave focus, is smaller and smaller because it has a larger L and M. Thus, ADS is nonlinearly unstable.
Wait, doesn't that imply that the perturbation theory breaks down?
Right, but that's exactly what one. Okay, so let us do Kerr, massive wave equation around Kerr. There's a mode that grows exponentially in time, right? Super radiance, as Vitor will tell us about. Why is this an instability? This is an instability because your perturbation theory breaks down. At a certain stage, this mode gets bigger than the mode you started with. The same thing here, except that it's not exponential. It's linear. It takes longer. I stress that the frequency of the mode that is growing in time is larger than any of the frequencies we started with. This is telling us that, in fact, the energy is being transferred to modes of higher and higher frequency, just like the onset of turbulence. Okay, there's a cascade direction. And in fact, when this mode becomes important, it will resonate with other modes and go even to higher and higher frequency towards smaller and smaller scales. If you're doing a quantum field theory, that's all that happens. But let us all think, if you're doing gravity, you're putting energy into smaller and smaller scales, what do you think will happen? Well, there's only a black hole has to form. It's the Hoop conjecture. But this is a leap of faith. Why do we say that this is true? Because there was this amazing paper, or this is certainly a possibility for the endpoint. There was this amazing paper where Bison and Rostorovsky, they have studied a spherically scalar field collapse in ADS. It's spherically symmetric, so you need to have a scalar field in order to generate your waves. And they find that no matter how small is the amplitude of the mode you started with, you eventually form a black hole. Okay? So this is what this graphic is telling. Let me explain this graphic because I find it amazing. This is taken from their paper. This is not our work. I wish it was, but it's not. So this is the amplitude of the wave that they start with. This is the location of the horizon. If the amplitude is large, you immediately form a black hole, okay, on the first trial. You start decreasing the amplitude. Eventually, you form a black hole of zero size. And around here, there's just Schottky critical phenomena. Just looks like flat space. It's really tiny. Well, you decrease a little bit the amplitude. What happens? Well, the wave goes through the origin, goes back, bounces off the wall, and on the second trial, it forms a black hole. You continue to decrease, and then it takes three trials to form a black hole, four, five, and so on. Sometimes they had to wait hundreds and hundreds of bounces in order to eventually see the formation of a black hole. For those of you who do numerics, this is unbelievable. They have a stable code that does hundreds and hundreds of bounces of the AdS ball, and they only see the formation of a black hole. Now, but it's really true that the endpoint will be a rotating black hole? This possibility,
can I ask something
yes.
before you move on? What happens to the radial quantum number? You're only quoting here L and M, but what happens to the P?
It so happens that this mode has P equal to zero.
So this is all happening in the sector with P.
No. As you generate more and more harmonics, I mean, P's have completely random numbers. But the mode that is growing in time, in this case, SP equals to
okay,
zero.
The reason I'm asking this is because of your claim that you're transferring energy into smaller and smaller scales. But let me take a second. Because higher P means that the
localized
wave function is actually P or main
right.
orbit further and further away from the origin.
Right. I agree.
So you're not really going to smaller scales if you're transferring energy to higher P's, right?
Right, right. I completely agree with you because P here for this specific mode is zero. But that's because I started with two modes with P equal to zero. If you start with the generic initial data with the Gaussian, say, there's all values of P. And then the modes that resonate, you'll have P turned on.
Right. And then the other question I had is that, perhaps what I'm going to say is too naive, but if you have a system of interacting harmonic oscillators, which is
yes.
essentially what you have
to yes.
do, if it's interacting, of course, if you put an initial amount of energy into any finite number of them,
mm-hmm.
what you expect is that the energy, because they are all interacting, will spread
mm-hmm.
over all of them or most of them, I don't know. And maybe the difference or the subtlety is that what you're saying is that it spreads in a way that some of them go linearly in time as opposed to just oscillating.
Right.
Is that the point?
That's exactly
that's
the point.
That's just a consequence of the fact that the
resonant frequencies are integers.
Yeah. That two of them can compose to give you a...
Perfect. That's exactly that.
But this is...
But if you do, you have to be careful. Because if the physics was just that, you would do the same exercise. And you would find that it's just a consequence of doing the wrong basis thing that I told you about with the harmonic oscillators. You have to be careful in the way that you do the harmonic oscillator. But the spirit is exactly that. That you have two harmonic oscillators. They're talking with each other. And these guys just oscillate in a way where they source... a resonant term for the guy that was next to them.
So you said it's a classic Fermi pasta Ulam situation.
The what?
Okay, so you don't know this.
No.
There is a classic situation where you couple harmonic oscillators, but I thought at the end you don't get a cascade.
That's what I'm telling you. In the examples that I'm familiar with, which perhaps is this, but I don't know the nomenclature. You have to be careful because this does not happen. It's an artifact. It seems that the mode is growing in time, but it's an artifact that you're using the wrong basis. You can remove these modes that are growing up in time by correcting the frequencies of the modes you started with.
Okay, but let me then do this because I'm failing to see in your approach.
Yes.
What information other than the basic frequencies and the coupling constants at every order?
Yes.
That you're using. It seems to me that's all you're using. So,
well,
so if I had just a system of harmonic oscillators and I couple them and I specify some coupling constant
mm-hmm.
at every order, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's exactly what you're modeling with no further information. It's just that those coupling constants here come from gravity.
But there's another one, is that the frequencies of these guys are all integers.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So if you allow me for integer frequencies, then it's true.
Resonance. So these guys basically, you have to kind of split into a bunch of them who are oscillating, that would
yes.
be your whatever phis.
Yes.
And then the rest are sort of like the source. That was your
yes.
T,
yes.
LM, whatever. And they're feeding into each other. And if the resonance happens because of this commensurability
yes.
of frequencies, then you get this linear growing mode.
Yes.
Right? And then, you know, that feeds back in.
And then grows.
Another linear growing mode. I think at the end, this is one of the first examples of chaos in nonlinear oscillators.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Possibility two. Possibility one relies on the stability of the Caridias black hole.
But possibility one already included negative singularity.
No, I mean,
yeah,
but
yeah,
only for very fine tuned.
Yeah, but I mean more than
so possibility one relies on the stability of the EDS, of the Caridias black hole. But I just told you that mathematicians purely simply do not believe in this. Okay? They say it's wrong. Forget it. ADS is all, you know, in their opinion, pardon my French, crap. So why do they say this? Basically, it's a tale of two timescales. So there's a timescale for the breakdown of perturbation theory in pure ADS. Okay? How can we estimate this? Well, it's easy. It's when the third order term becomes of the same order as the first order term. Then perturbation theory breaks down. So that's when T epsilon cube is of the same order as epsilon, which gives you a time scale that goes like epsilon to the minus 2. This time scale was confirmed numerically by Bizot and Rostorovsky. That's precisely the time scale it takes to form a black hole. It scales in this way, and it's predicted by our perturbation theory. Okay. Now, we have to compare this with the time it takes for a given perturbation to be absorbed by a black hole. The standard law is it's exponential in time because of quasi-normal modes. However, I'm going to try to argue that this is a rather crude and incomplete answer. Each mode will decay exponentially, but it's not true that the generic perturbation will decay exponentially. In fact, it will take a lot longer. Okay? Why? Consider a minimally coupled scalar field in the background of a Schwarzschild ADS black hole, for simplicity. Okay, then you can decompose everything in a Fourier series and in spherical harmonics. Okay, good. Now you calculate the quasi-normal modes, and you find something that people have not really picked up in the literature. The imaginary part of the quasi-normal mode, for very large L, decays exponentially. This means that there are some modes that are extremely long-lived. Okay. And this is precisely the inverse of the time it takes for a given mode to be absorbed. So modes with very large L take a very long time to be absorbed. Please.
It's just a comment. It's not that it hasn't been observed.
No. It has been observed, but it has not picked out in this way that I'm going to say here. No, it has been observed. I mean, people have calculated where is. Vitor has calculated the quasi-normal modes, Schwarzschild ADS black holes, and immediately says this there. But it was not picked out in this way. Yeah. So if I offended anybody, my sincere apologies.
You're saying that the quasi-normal mode for large quantum numbers approaches the real axis.
But very, very fast.
Exponential.
Exponentially fast.
That's known.
No, it's known. It's known. For the planar case, it's also known. For the planar case, it's also known, but it's not exponential. It's a very mild power law. For the global case, it's very, very strong. Okay? So large L modes are very, very long-lived. Yes.
Exponentially?
Yeah. No, on the other hand, if you want finiteness of the energy in a given finite Sobolev space, okay, this means that the pointwise estimate for the size of the scalar field grows with the order of your Sobolev space as L to the 3 minus 2s. Forget about Sobolev spaces. In the next part, I'll show you what happens for an infinite Sobolev space. Okay. Now, if you're studying the stability of the Minkowski space, what you impose is H3, which is S equal to 3. So your pointwise estimate gives L to the minus 3. So the scalar field will only decay logarithmic with time. Now, you might complain, this is finite Sobolev space. Who cares? Well, in fact, I would argue that this is the physical thing to do, but OK. If you take the smooth limit, all functions are smooth, then it decays as a power law. But it decays as a power law with t to the minus delta, where delta just has to be bigger than zero. So it takes a very, very long time. Okay? And we have confirmed these estimates numerically. But this is just true, unless we have made a mistake. Adding rotation only makes it worse. We have studied this around CurrEDS. It is even more long-lived, because the modes that co-rotate with a black hole even live longer. So it seems that our turbulent instability might have time to develop in the domain of outer communications of the Schwarzschild black hole. Now, you might be worried, because you say, but there's no resonances, so why is this possible? But the precise same modes that are very long-lived have very, very good resonances. Indeed, the real part approaches the normal modes of ADS, plus a correction that decreases with the number of dimensions.
Is that because these modes are supported in the UV, and therefore
they almost feel like ADS? Another way to say this is to do the following, which Bob Wold pointed out to us. You take the Schwarzschild black hole, you boost it to put it almost at infinity, close to the boundary. And then if you consider a little wave that was here in the middle, well, it will barely feel that guy that is very, very far away. So if our instability was occurring in pure EDS, it's likely to occur here as well.
The black hole will come back.
No. You boost it. You put it in an orbit. This is possible to do. You put it in an orbit. But note that this depends on the number of dimensions. It turns out, for technical reasons, that we can only really show that our instability, in principle, will be there if the dimension is bigger than 6. If you want, I can go through this. But mainly, it's because this approach has to be sufficiently fast. For d equals 4 and d equals 5, we need your help. We don't know if the instability is there or not. So in this setup, what is the endpoint? Well, start with a generic perturbation about Schwarzschild ADS. Then this perturbation will likely form a new black hole outside, the one that you started with, far away, because it's focused towards the UV. This black hole, which we have coined black planet, will merge with the central black hole. As it does so, it radiates. The radiation will now get stuck there, out at infinity. So you go to 2. You form a new black hole. But now these black holes will be ever, they'll be smaller and smaller and smaller, because part of the energy was absorbed by the central black hole. Eventually, if you wait a very, very long time, an infinite amount of time, well, you have to start using quantum mechanics. So in spirit, this has violated the cosmic censorship. In spirit. In reality, the cosmic censorship says it has to be in a finite amount of time, like Lewis and friends have observed in the Gray-Lafon instability. Here you have to wait an infinite amount of time. But eventually, you have to use quantum mechanics, which already smells fishy.
So let's see. I still understand why you call this turbulent instability, because I don't see energy cascades and scaling. But OK, I'm trying to get the picture. These black planets, basically, what you would do in turbulence, if I'm forcing the fluid in such a way so I create a vortex, as I get to shorter distances, the vortex would experience instability. It would split.
Yes.
And then the cascade, the other
happens. Yes.
Split. So the black planet, you create one black planet, then how do you, does the black planet split?
What happens is that this black planet will. This black planet. So this is different. This is not pure EDS.
Okay.
So here, I'm not even sure if we can call this turbulence at all. But here, the spirit is that this black hole merges, and the different black hole is now created with a smaller size, because the radiation that this guy emits gets now itself trapped outside. So it's not the splitting, it's more and more black holes that are formed in the outside, in the exterior of the domain of outer communications.
And you cut off, the cutoff is provided by the
eventually it evaporates.
The same way that there you have the molecular
viscosity. Right.
So that requires that radiation has extremely large.
A generic radiation will have this. And this is part, this is why we need this strong thing.
So this conjecture is for d equals 6 and above?
No. So this depends on who you ask in our collaboration. I strongly think, but I only speak by myself, I strongly think that this will also happen in 4 and in 5. You can quote me on that, even though people might just not pay any attention. Because I think this is a problem that we have not used Einstein equations in almost any of this. We have only used Einstein's equations in one place to estimate the time scale it takes to form a black hole. But the rest is just PD theory, because we can't do anything more. We don't know the intricacies of the Einstein equations. But my feeling is, in ADS, if you have the opportunity to form a black hole, you just form it. So I think this is a technical issue. But numerics is most welcome to test it.
So one more question. Wouldn't you ask yourself, non-linear effect wouldn't drive the frequency of this quasi-bound state mode upwards and tunneling into the black hole?
But that's why you need this bound. Because if there are, that's exactly these frequencies, you would expect that. But at the same time, the growth rate is very, very tiny. So the probability it actually tunnels through decays exponentially. They're extremely long-lived. I can show you the plots. I mean, these estimates that we have, they fit only too well. Radiates.
It emits gravitational radiation. That gravitational radiation will have a very particular spectrum.
Right.
It's not going to be generic. So it's
No.
Are you sure that the waves that are generated
there? They will have a very large L tail, and that's because of this decay. We can estimate that.
So, eventually, at the same time, you will form.
This is not, if you're a relativist, as I think you identify yourself as one. So if you're a pure relativist, you wouldn't call this a violation of the cosmic censorship, because they want it in finite amount of time. At least.
But I mean, the sense that you said, that's something that happens because at infinite time you form a.
Yeah, and then you take it an epsilon away from infinity, or they need quantum mechanics to do something. So what happens when you include quantum effects? Okay, the upshot is there is no instability. So consider type 2b in ADS 5 process 5. I'm almost done, so don't worry. We still have time for coffee. Consider type 2b in string in ADS 5 process 5. Now there's two length scales. There's a Planck scale, and then there's a string energy scale. If you want string theory to be useful, we take ES smaller than EP. Now there's four possibilities. If the energy is sufficiently large, okay, bigger than the five-dimensional Planck scale, you form a five-dimensional black hole. That's the setup that I just described. The energy becomes a little bit smaller, then what happens is the following. There's a different energy in game, which is this so-called correlation energy, which is the energy of a 10-dimensional black hole with the string size. Okay? If you give an energy between these two, then you form a 10-dimensional black hole. Okay? If you give an energy below this guy, well, you can't even form a black hole. The only thing that you do is you excite the string. So right here, I wouldn't already call this an instability. And if you give an energy that is even below this, then you just get a gas of particles. The upshot is, if the black hole is really tiny, okay, it's just Hawking evaporates so fast that you wouldn't call this an instability. But that's the upshot. Implications for the field theory. Well, the fact that one evolves towards a state of maximum entropy can be viewed as thermalization, not in the canonical ensemble, where you keep the temperature fixed, in the microcanonical ensemble. Okay, but you're evolving towards a state of maximum entropy. It's still thermalization, as was pointed out by Joe. You look.
What do you mean by the ensemble, by the canonical ensemble, you are at equilibrium? You don't fix temperature.
No, but here, right. But here we are, what I'm saying is.
You mean it's fixed energy?
Here it's fixed energy.
Okay, but that's so, the only
yeah,
that we can talk about.
It depends.
If you're out of equilibrium?
No, if you're out of equilibrium, it's a fair comment. You can't even define temperature. So all theories with the gravity dual will show this cascade of energy, so like the pure ADS case, like the onset of turbulence. And a perhaps much more intriguing thing that you would have not learned if you just did the field theory calculation. So you see, from the perspective of the field theory, I think it's obvious that the anti-de-Sitter has to be unstable. Because the theory lives on a spatially compact manifold. You kick it. I mean, what do you expect that it will do? It will thermalize. That's the formation of a black hole. But if you just stayed with that statement, you would have never uncovered the fact that there's these special states that just do not seem to thermalize. They just stay on the sphere, rotating, and they just don't thermalize.
Can I rephrase this? I would put it differently. Let me know if you agree. If I keep the gauge theory in a way that I put it in an excited pure state,
mm-hmm.
of course, it would not thermalize, strictly speaking. It would always stay in a pure state. But
yes,
a generic kick will eventually look thermal for a long time.
Right.
What you're saying here is, I think, that there are some pure states which somehow look, you can describe classically on the dual side.
Right.
Okay.
They're coherent states. They're coherent states of single excitations. So what this smells like is that even though these are large multi-trace deformations, you know, where I think even Pedro would agree that there might not be some hope for integrability for this case, these guys still seem to be a little bit integrable because they still exist and they still have a gravity discrepancy, even though we don't know why.
But the surprise is that under these highly non-generic states, which still have...
No, these ones are not generic. The gyons are...
Non-generic.
Oh, non-generic state. Yeah, yeah. Non-generic. Perfect. We're looking at that as we speak. My computer right now is searching for fuzzballs as we speak. You can even hear it if you. Yeah. I mean, except that the fuzzballs need more hair. They need more hair.
I mean, but in the fuzzball format, you after the generic
states. Yeah. You not it, it right. So they need a lot more hair, but we're looking for
so
them.
Computer,
it's after just as we speak. I can even show you what it's doing.
But wouldn't you say that any perturbation will lead you into this kind of scenario that you consider?
No, any perturbation, I think, will thermalize. Unless, as Alex pointed out yesterday, that perturbation, if that perturbation is intimately connected with a conserved global charge, then it's different. But even if you have a perturbation that is connected with conserved global charge, like a boson star, and if you break axial symmetry, of course, that guy will excite gravity. If it excites gravity.
No, but imagine you have your black hole and you send some perturbation. It's completely generic. Some of it would fall into the black hole. The other one would stay outside and it would go through this story. So
yeah.
Why would you say that these states are just very particular states?
Right.
So
that's where I think our that's where I think our perspective on thermalization has to somehow change. Because if this is true, that's an if. But if this is true, you have a black hole. But you have tiny black holes being formed outside. So it seems that if you are able to describe a chunk of space-time, which is a very difficult thing to do in ADS-CFT, it has to do with locality, nobody, I think it's fair to say, knows, then you are able to isolate some part of your CFT that has not yet thermalized, because it just creates another black hole. You see, so if you look at higher and higher port correlation functions, that's what this seems to indicate. They take longer to thermalize. But I think this is also an obvious statement. In fact, I think there's no system in nature because of the KM theorem that indeed thermalizes completely. It's very difficult.
I think this is contradictory with what Chesler and Tini write in a paper where they say that once you know how the 1 point and 2 point function thermalizes, then you know how the rest thermalizes. I agree with that. I think that once you sort of can establish that your black hole horizon is almost static, then that pretty much guarantees.
But it's not. But it's not almost static because there's more and more black holes being formed outside. It's not strictly speaking static.
So
if this is true, it's not specific.
So I want to understand that again. You know, even the pictures. So what you're saying is the black hole that in some sense around the black hole, in some sense in this Quantum domain of the membrane, if you want, you're creating this small black hole. Is that
yes.
Right?
There's some black hole.
That's the fuzz that presumably has something to do with this particular state. But then, you know, I mean, if you're talking about this existence of very special states, I mean, these are not generic.
No, these ones are not generic at all. It's so surprising that they're there.
I don't understand what the question of thermalization means for non-generic states.
No. Yeah. I mean, look, I completely agree with you. What is striking is that if you kick it, your CFT in a very special way, very, very, very special, unbelievably fine-tuned, these structures just keep going there without dissipating. This is like a quark-packed debris soliton. I mean, it just stays there, and it doesn't go away. Quantum mechanically stable. I don't know. I mean, they have a higher energy than ADS. So I suspect they're quantum mechanically.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking particles, whether one could get some
Yeah, quantum tunneling close to the horizon, like in the fuzzballs, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know that you can describe often like the solution that has a classical instability, a supervision instability, and you might have used this in order to argue that the fuzzball picture can be different, like
something like the Hawking,
picture for a Hawking variation. Now, when you're saying that this is an idea of classical stable,
they're nonlinear. I strongly believe that they're nonlinearly unstable.
Unstable,
nonlinear, but it's a much, much larger time scale. It's like ergodic. Yeah. Unless there's another surprise. There might be another surprise.
So
we don't know.
These GMs are solitons and they have no horizon. Right?
Yes, they have no horizon.
But the mechanism is quite different from the solitons.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a monopole anti monopole configuration, which is always behind all the other solitons in the D1D5.
But now that you mentioned this,
these are
not topological solids. Right. They're not. They're really Quartz-Vaguely solitons.
Yeah. So these are lumps of energy.
Yeah.
Going around.
Yeah, just go around.
And somehow, despite the nonlinearities of gravity,
they stay there.
They don't disperse.
Yeah. Just stay there, sitting like a duck, back and forth. What do you mean by size?
I mean, you have some particular some characteristics.
I can't tell that very much because I only have the perturbative result. So in simple circumstances, I can show you plots of the energy, but generically, I can't really answer to that. That's in asymptotically flat.
Sure, but at least in that case, I'm trying to get a typical size of the geon based on the energy, and they scale that way, so it's smaller.
Okay.
No, that's almost guaranteed.
Yeah.
No, they're more or less picked around that we know.
It's ADS size.
It's more or less ADS size, yeah.
But if it is ADS size, it's in the cross section of your black hole and you're going to be eating that.
No. I mean, look, if you are, the higher the value of L and M, the more you get close to the UV. Okay? And the problematic guys in generating this instability are the really high L modes.
Pretty high L modes.
It's concentrated, but it's also far off.
If your geon had a single
killing one
vector, it was time-like across the entire.
I'm very happy you asked that. So we have calculated the boundary stress energy tensor, and it contains regions of negative and positive energy density around the equator. Here it is. So pay a close look at this, Lewis. I think it seems more or less like what you were saying, even though it can't have anything to do with it, unfortunately. So there's a azimuthal coordinate, and there's the latitude coordinate, and there's the pockets. There's one killing field. That killing field is time-like near the poles, space-like near the equator. OK? You're all looking at me. Space-like? Are you trying to explain the opera results or something like that? But no, the only thing that this means is that this state is so special that it seems it travels faster than light. Let me give you a very simple example. Take your Christmas tree lights, okay, and set each one of them to work independently of each other. And fine-tune it in a way that it looks that there's an information that is traveling faster than light. But it isn't. It's just that you have fine-tuned this in a very, very specific way. It's the same here. It's a lighthouse effect. It's a phase velocity, if you want. OK, I finally come to the conclusions and open questions. I'm so sorry I've massively over, Anti-de-Sitter space is nonlinear and unstable. Generic small perturbations become large. And I stress, it's probably form black holes. You need numerics. For some linearized gravity modes, there is an exact non-singular geon if our theory, asymptotic series converges. We don't know. The dual field theory shows this generic turbulent cascade to a maximum interstellar space, but there are some special states that do not thermalize. Open questions. We would love to have a singularity theorem for anti-de-Sitter space. There's some hope in this, because anti-de-Sitter space almost acts like a closed universe. It's remarkably difficult to do this. We're trying very hard with Gary, but.
Can you prove it for Minkowski space in a box?
It's a good question, but I don't know. And we'd like to understand the state of CFT states that do not thermalize. Let me give you another example of a state that does not thermalize. It's trivial from the perspective of the bulk. Take a global black hole inside ADS, boost it a little bit. It will wobble around the center of ADS. McGreevy and all have studied these guys, and this corresponds to some non-trivial solutions on your boundary that do not thermalize. These guys are different. In fact, for trivial diffeomorphisms, the Kodama-Ishibashi variables would all be zero. So this is not just diffeomorphisms, something else. And let me finish. I'd like to find the endpoint, if any, of the time evolution of the anti-de Sitter turbulent instability. Thank you.